Wow, this is a delight to see so many people on a Sunday evening. Hopefully, those of you who have kind of gone through the whole thing since Friday night, tonight we want to try to bring all of that into an understanding. But just so you know, there's so much going on right now in the scientific community that it's causing basically almost panic within the system. I have friends who are still, you know, they're still hanging on. A couple of them are really close, but they just got to hang on to their religion of science. But they've told me they're just having more and more difficulty. I teach a 16-week course at the Bible College, and I still can't cover all the material. So trying to do it in, you know, 3 days is, you know, really just trying to hit the highlights. But just know that, as Pastor Terry said, you know, we serve a big God. The power, you know, one of the things that I had when I first accepted Christ in 1987, it was 1 month after my 40th birthday. And I remember I came kicking and screaming. It was not some warm fuzzy, you know, because I had held out to the end. But I kept trying to bring God down and put him in the box and make him fit my finite mind. And isn't that absurd? Here we have this infinite God that we try to bring down, and we think, well, if it's too hard for me or some of my colleagues to understand, then, you know, how absurd. But that's where the pride comes in. You know, I told the people on Friday, you know, I'm not here because of some great scientific discovery, or I'm not here because of some pastor or some religious moment. I'm here because my mother and my grandmother never stopped praying for me. See, everybody else gave up. See, I could avoid the Christians, and I did. I didn't listen to Christian TV, watch any Christian, read Christian music. I didn't hang around Christians. I wouldn't even go to any family functions, mainly, as I said this morning, because they wouldn't invite me. I was such a jerk. But I wouldn't go anyway. I wouldn't open birthday cards or Christmas cards from any member of my family. And sometimes I could see a check or a gift certificate in it. I'd throw it in the trash unopened. That's how hardened my heart was. And it took a volcano. And I showed that eruption of Mount St. Helens. That erupted May 18th, 1980. Changed my life. But it took 7 years. 7 years of in-my-face research before I could finally crumble. But the bottom line was, I chose not to believe in God because of my lifestyle. I did not want to be accountable to a God, let me tell you. I didn't want to share the glory with God. But I have come to realize that, you know what, that's your right to choose not to believe in God. See, God created you with the ability to make choices, and one of the choices you can make is not to believe in God. I can't argue with you if you tell me you don't choose to believe in God because you don't want to. I'll feel sorry for you. I'll pray for you, but that's your business. But don't come to me and say, I don't believe in God because of all the evidence that's been... No, now I'll argue with you, because there's none. And that's what we've been showing, is that there's two sides to every story. But there's only two choices. It's either man's word or God's word. There's no middle ground. And what does God say about the middle ground, or walking the fence anyway? So the bottom line is, you have to make a choice. Where are you going to put your faith? And see, I had absolute 100% faith in my religion, which was science. But I find it interesting, because science took me away from God. But that science brought me back. You see, at age 14, I remember, that's when that hormone kicks in that gives you all wisdom. And boy, I got a kick. I'd started to think I knew more than my parents, and then all of a sudden I knew more than my parents. But see, I had been taught to respect my elders, and particularly teachers. If I had ever been sent home for disrespecting a teacher, guys, spankings were definitely in order in my day, let me tell you. I would never have treated a teacher the way I was treated when I became a teacher. And I taught high school for years. Then after I got my graduate degree, I ended up teaching at the university. I became a superintendent of schools. So I've been in education most of my life. But I remember my first day of high school, how excited I was, how, you know, at 14, you know, this is so exciting. I could take real science. And I was a science nerd from the get-go. And as I told you before, you know, I have all these degrees. I have a PhD in evolutionary biology, but I specialized in herpetology and zoology. Those were some of my affairs. Archaeology, I have a master's degree in geology, a master's degree in education. I belong to all of these things. But God doesn't need all those letters. The reason I'm telling you that is because that's how hard I tried to prove that science had the answers. I'm currently involved in several major research projects. So when I told my mom I was going to prove it, I meant it. But it was interesting because I grew up in a Christian home. And to me, to be a Christian meant you were born in America. That was number one. Number two, you had to go to church. And my grandmother had a way of motivating us. It was called a willow branch. And number three, you prayed at meals. If you met those, you're a Christian. And then I grew up in the hills of Wofford, Kentucky. Now, I spoke in Kentucky last year, and there were people who had never heard of Wofford. Population 400 when I was there. Today is about 395. I'm telling you, I went to a Southern Baptist church in the hills of Kentucky, and I'll tell you, that's an experience in itself. If you've never seen a good Southern Baptist preacher, I knew a lot about the fear of the Lord. And I thought fire was going to come out of his mouth. So when I got into high school, and by the way, that was a story itself. We moved from Wofford, Kentucky, right straight to Newport Beach, California. Culture shock was, you know, I was wearing those little Oshkosh overalls. I was wearing them before they were cool. And I remember my first day of school in Newport Beach. I walked down the sidewalk, I had a little brown bag with my bologna sandwich and my Oshkosh, and I kind of shuffle into the school, and I look in the back, and there was an empty seat, so I kind of shuffled in there, and the teacher did a terrible thing. She saw me, and she said, "Oh, class, here we have a new student. This is little Ricky from Kentucky," and she had me come up front. That's a terrible thing to do to a kid. So I'm standing there, and all these eyes are staring at me, and she makes this big deal. So what am I supposed to do? So I just said, "Howdy, y'all." Kids can be merciless. I learned a new word my first day of school, hick, and I was one. But things smoothed out, you know, and over the next few years, like I said, on the way to 14, you know, it was really cool living in Newport in those days. John Wayne just lived six blocks from me. Man, wow, it was exciting. Then my first day of high school, I took biology first period. Most of my friends took study hall, but I was science. But I had a reason, because the first period biology teacher was also the freshman football coach. So yeah, hello God. There he was, this tall, good-looking scholar from Pepperdine University, great athlete, great scholar. I found my God. Well, he was standing there waiting for everybody to get in, and this was in 1962, and I remember everybody files in, and he's Ivy League, really nice-looking guy, and he stands there. Then he smiles, and he looks out over the class, and this is where my life changed. He said, "Before we get started, class, I need to ask a question. Are any of you in this class, are any of you Christians?" Now, I thought, what is that, and what does that have to do with your first day of high school? I looked around the room, and there's probably 30 kids in the class, and five or six hands went up. And I figured, well, I'm one of those, so I raised my hand. And he smiled, and he says, "I want to apologize to those of you who just raised your hand and said you're Christians, because by the time the semester's over, you won't be." Talk about, you know, the hormones going crazy, but I'm thinking, I was so confused, my stomach turns in knots, and I think, well, I didn't know. Was my mom and grandmother lying to me? What's this all about? I mean, it was a nightmare. But immediately he starts handing out our textbooks. Right on the cover, Charles Darwin. Immediately he starts to tell us how there was no need for a God, and how the Bible couldn't be true because we evolved from this warm little pond of chemicals and spontaneously generated into life, and we just have gone right on through, up through the primates, into through the chimps, into humans. Wow. I mean, you know, he said, you won't be a Christian by the time the semester's over. I wasn't by the time the day was over. I made up my mind that science had the answers and that religion was a myth. Now, I couldn't wait to get home. I majored in obnoxiousness, so I had an edge here. So I remember I walked in at 14. I was taller than my mom now, which was cool. You know, I walked in. Hey, come here, Mom. Put my arm around her. I said, Mom, I'm 14. I'm in high school. I know everything. You can take this Jesus stuff and put it over Santa Claus and Easter Bunny. It's a myth. You know, that was not a smart thing to say to a good Southern Baptist prayer warrior woman. No, 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 no. My sweet, calm, little, passive mother became downright hostile. I mean, I knew I was in trouble immediately because the color drained out of her face. Then these veins started to pulsate. And then the finger came out and she couldn't even talk. And that finger went on my nose and she's... Don't be none of that talk in this house, young man. And she reached out and grabbed a Bible. There were Bibles hanging from the ceiling in her pockets on the floor. She had Bibles everywhere. She was a Jesus freak. You know, she actually put red marks and yellow marks in the Bible, you know. So she starts quoting scripture. I just smiled and grabbed my textbook and I start quoting Darwin. Now, my mother was a great prayer warrior lady. She was just unprepared to defend her faith scientifically to an obnoxious 14-year-old. That's why we need to hear this stuff. Because I had her in tears in a hurry. Finally, she just kind of standing in the middle of the room, and I knew I was kind of torn because she starts sobbing. The spirit just drains out of her. She drops the little Bible she has on the floor, and she shuffles over to the bookstand where she picked up the big family Bible. You know, it has our whole history in it and all the pictures. I've never seen her lift this sucker by herself before, you know. And I'm thinking, what is she going to quote out of the big one that wasn't in the little one, you know? Nothing. She just ran out and bam! Whoa. Now, that's not so funny. It was not a love tap. My mother clobbered me with the Bible, folks. That is not a good witnessing tool. It hurt. It made me mad. And so now I turned on her and I got the finger out and I says, I will show you. See, I made a vow at 14. That's why I have all these degrees and all this stuff. And it was a miserable time till the Lord finally got my attention. And so hopefully some of this stuff will help you understand that it is okay to believe that this book is 100% true. Russ showed this earlier, and by the way, Russ and I both have some really great resources. Russ has 5 books that he's written, but his latest one, It's About Time, is awesome. I have 3 one-hour lectures. Everything that I did Friday, yesterday, and today is all on here in the DVD, 3 one-hour lectures. So those of you who missed, and then I have a one-hour, this one was just done recently by Tucson Calvary Chapel. And then we have a lot of books, and this one is really good. It's called Censored Science. There's no such thing that fits, you know, a book that fits all, but this one really gives you a lot of the main things. And I have to touch on this because a couple of people asked me, I do a whole session on just global warming, but in the interest of time, this is called Meltdown. This is by Dr. Patrick J. Michaels. And this is probably the best thing. It says, Meltdown, the predictable distortion of global warming by scientists, politicians, and the media. And I have a DVD on global warming back there as well. But I find it interesting because I had some kids come to one of our lectures, and these young kids were sobbing. And I thought, what's the matter? And they had just come from a class where they were told they were all going to, by the time they got my age, they were all going to drown because the ice caps are melting. That's just wrong. And then I looked up to see, what does God say about that? Well, in Job 38:8 through 11, look what he says. It says, who shut up the sea with doors when it break forth as if it had issued out of the womb? Then in 11 it says, this far and hitherto shalt thou come, but no further, and here shall your proud waves be stayed. See, God is telling us that he's already prepared a place for the oceans and where they will be and how far they can rise. And the glaciers have been melting for 8,000 years, according to the science themselves. So don't panic. Don't go buy a boat. But see here, John 3:12, Jesus, it says, if I have told you earthly things and ye believe not, how shall ye believe if I tell you of heavenly things? Boy, isn't that a fact? But one thing we need to do as Christians is work as a team. You know, as I said this morning, some of the worst attacks I've had have come from within the church. It was like painting a target on my back once I announced I was a creationist. And as I said about, you know, Martin Luther King Jr., and his quote says, attack the false idea, not the man who holds the idea. Well, what we need to do is not attack anything. Pray for each other. But I thought this was a pretty good example here of teamwork. And maybe it's a good example of evolution, because look how far these two critters have evolved. Watch this. There should be sound, but I... Ah, there it is.
There's a new Sainsbury's pet food. Scouts for dogs and paws for cats. Carefully balanced to provide all the nourishment your pet needs to stay healthy, active, and remarkably alert.
Teamwork. See how much more we can accomplish when we work together. Now, I mentioned yesterday, then again this morning, that 99% of the information that we use in our lectures comes from the scientific community. New Scientist, Scientific American, Nature. This one is actually Time Magazine. I found this one interesting. Time Magazine, it says, reconciling God and science. Genome mapper Francis Collins is also an evangelical Christian. And he talks about reconciling science. And we're going to talk about the genome in a few minutes and how important that is. But this is the first paragraph out of the National Academy of Science manual. And you can pick up that manual at any college bookstore. It came out in 1999. I think somebody just told me they revised it a little bit. But first of all, that should make you nervous when they say National Academy of Science. See, each state is responsible for their science education, math. Each state has a framework. In fact, I wrote the curriculum for the science school that I was a superintendent of based on the California science framework. Each state has a framework for math, science, reading, all of that sort of thing. So when the National Science Academy comes out and tells you how to teach, basically it is illegal for them to mandate to the states how to teach. So rather than make it mandatory, guess what they did? They just said, this is just a guideline, and we strongly suggest you use it. But of course, if you don't, that's your right, but we'll withhold your federal funding. How many states can afford that? But I want you to read this definition. It's not my definition. It's not some creationist definition. We didn't make this up. This came out from the... But by the way, the definition was written to keep science out of the... creation out of the science classroom. Because they classify creation or religion as metaphysics. So science is a particular way of knowing about the world. In science, explanations are limited to those based on observations and experiments that can be substantiated by other scientists. Explanations that cannot be based on empirical evidence are not a part of science. You guys catch that? I mean, that's pretty clear, right? But I highlighted empirical in red because let's find out, make sure that I'm not missing something, that everybody's on the same page as to what empirical means. So I looked it up. Merriam-Webster Dictionary says originating in or based on observation or experience, relying on experience or observation alone, capable of being verified by observation. That's pretty clear, right? I had an opportunity a few years back to speak to 600 scientists and science teachers in a conference down in Southern California. Guys, that is definitely intimidating. And the only time I was more nervous is when my mother was sitting in the audience. But I was a wreck. And I remember, now, what do I do? Some of these people in this classroom, in this conference, were my mentors, my heroes. And I asked them a couple of questions. And I asked that question this morning. One of them was, how do we date fossils? The number one way. Well, that entire audience told me, just like 90% of you did this morning, carbon-14. And that just stumped me. Because carbon-14 cannot date fossils. It can only date carbon-based artifacts. You know, like real bone, real wood, real tissue, real blood. We can date the mummies in the Egyptian tombs. We can date the frozen rhinos. We can date the soft tissue found in the T-Rex bones that we showed you earlier. But you can't date rock. The other problem is carbon-14 cannot and has never been used by anybody. As a secular scientist, and by the way, as I told you this morning, I was not an atheist. That was way too passive for me. I was an anti-Christian. I gave lower grades to some of my students just because they were Christians. So I had a massive guilt trip when I accepted Christ. First of all, I was embarrassed when I went back and looked at my own research, at what I had been doing and what I had believed. And I accused the Christians of having blind faith. And I believed in aliens. I don't know, I guess I had more faith. But when I asked that audience about the dating and they told me that, I was stumped. But the next question I really got them with. Based on this definition, if it's not empirical, it's not part of science. I asked this room full of scientists, I said, can anybody in this room just give me just one example of empirical Darwinian evolution? I got a room full of silence. Do you see the problem? If it's not empirical, it's not part of science, and you can't give me one empirical reason, but that's ridiculous, because how would you empirically prove spontaneous generation? Well, I'm going to show you a guy who tried it. His name is Dr. David Deamer from UC Santa Cruz. We'll see him in a few minutes. But how would you empirically prove the Big Bang? See, that's nuts. You can't do it. It's based on faith. That's why this morning I showed you Michael Ruse, a philosopher from Florida State, says we're talking about creationism and evolutionism are two religions. Evolutionism is a secular religion. Creationism is a Christian or a biblical religion, but they both require great faith. You just have to figure out where you put it. That's why the math is so important. How many people were not here this morning? Raise your hand. Because I don't want to just repeat everything, but as I said this morning, the math is overwhelming. Ologies are wonderful. I loved ologies. That's why I have all these degrees and all these different ologies. Ology just means the study of. It's when we add math to our ologies, we find how well it's doing. And the laws of probability. You know, in 1962, the laws of probability as far as one single random act of Darwinian evolution was 10 to the 50th power. That's awesome. That's huge. But you could all write that number, 50 zeros. But in 20 years, when the advent of the computers, and we could now do calculations that no one in the scientists of the past couldn't even imagine, that number jumped to 40,000 zeros. And then to today, 2012, that number is 10 to 10 to the 123rd power. That is a big sideways 8, folks. So you see the type of faith I had with the math? But let's hold now the rest of what I show you according to the National Academy of Science standard of if it's not empirical, it's not part of science. See, what I suggest, and my hope, and my prayers are that we would teach everything. I prided myself in teaching both sides as a teacher. Of course, I tainted my side, you know, because that was my belief. That was my philosophical worldview. But at least I put it out there. Today, it's illegal to put it out there. That's just plain wrong. Let's just teach all of it, put all of the evidence, the empirical evidence we have, lay it out on tables for miles, step back and shut up, and let you use the brains God has given you. Then where you fall is up to you and your God, not me. So why don't we just do that? Let's just call them both religions, teach it both, call them both science, creation science, evolution science, whatever, but let's stop trying to withhold information. If it's not empirical, it's not part of science. So if it's not empirical, what is it? It's a miracle. See, because I believed in a miracle. That was that first spontaneous generation. But now, based on that definition, if it's not empirical, how about this definition? The second law of thermodynamics and evolution. The second law, you see how that's termed? It's not the second theory. It's not the second hypothesis. It's the second law. See, once it becomes a law, that means it has been tested and confirmed. You see how that works? The second law of thermodynamics is an empirical law, directly observable in nature and in experiments. The law implies that the direction of all natural processes is toward states of disorder. All natural systems degenerate when left to themselves. Huxley, who was one of Darwin's good buddies, states that evolution is an irreversible process which leads to greater variety and more complex order. His assertion, look at this, contradicts the second law of thermodynamics. It goes in direct contradiction to it. So either evolution has occurred in spite of the second law, or evolution has not occurred at all. See, now that's good science. That's based on empirical information. The first and second laws of thermodynamics, the law of gravity. But see, that's why I had to believe in evolution in spite of the evidence, because it would contradict, when it was in direct conflict to what we know as a law. And then I told you, you know, quantum physics really gets weird. String theory, singularities, all these things. But Alan Guth was from MIT, is one of the go-to evolutionary scientists. But I wanted to just read this. This is out of Scientific American. And let's see how this flows with that definition, empirical. The so-called grand guess, do you see we have a problem already? How does a grand guess fall into the empirical realm? You see? Was put forth by MIT astrophysicist Alan Guth. According to this concept, the infinitesimal particle of space-time, which exploded in the Big Bang, had to first go through a period of cosmic inflation, which presumably, see, there's another word that kind of contradicts empirical, would solve the various difficulties present in the unmodified Big Bang theory. There is the problem. When I interviewed teachers to teach at my school, not a single one of them had any idea that there was a problem with the Big Bang. On the cover of Scientific American that I showed you on yesterday, right on the cover, it says the Big Bang Theory needs to be fixed or replaced. Now, why would you fix or replace it if it wasn't broken? You see, but the students don't know this. So the latter is said to be a singularity. Now watch this, where the equations describing the phenomenon of the expansion cease to apply. At such places, physics dissolves into what? Metaphysics. Whoops. These mathematical points admit of no explanation. They just are. Scientists can't explain singularities. That means they don't know how to explain the Big Bang. Now, where did that come from? Did that come from a group of Christians or creationists? That's in Scientific American, folks. The problem with metaphysics is that keeps it out of the science classroom, but look at this. Now, can you imagine if I stood up in front of a college, a group of college students and told them, excuse me, that God just is. They'd throw me out of the auditorium. But I can stand up there and say that they admit of no explanation, they just are. No, we've got to have it both ways. You can't have it just your way. Let's put it all out there. You see, that's all we're asking. I'm not asking that we don't teach evolution. My PhD says right on it, evolution. Evolutionary biology. That makes me a professional evolutionist. I am an evolutionist. I know evolution works. I can make it work. I've evolved into the creationist I am today. Works for me. See, evolution just means change. It's when we put micro and macro in front of it that we get into trouble. I love this. This is from William Nesbitt and from his book, Illusion of Time. He's an MD, but he kind of got it right. He says, scientists are reductionists. They think they can find reality by dividing things into smaller and smaller units. They learn more and more about less and less until they finally know everything there is to know about nothing at all. They can tell us everything about the design, structure, and operation of the universe, but they say nothing about the information it's transmitting from the God who created it. What they are telling us are true lies. See, that's what I was doing. I was telling true lies. Not on purpose. I didn't know that I was deceived. I just passed my deception on to my students. That's why prayer works. You know, we talked about this morning a little bit about quintessence, and that's a name that they lump dark matter and dark energy into these one group. And quintessence, when you look up the definition, says inherently invisible and undetectable. How does that fit with the empirical definition? But I thought this was rather interesting. It says, dark matter is thought to consist of an enormous swarm of invisible particles left over from the Big Bang. At this point, the leading candidate for dark matter is a neutralino, a theoretical particle 100 times heavier than a hydrogen atom that has never been detected. Dark matter is often paired. Now, they think they might have detected something called the Higgs boson, but yet all they have found is the residue, not the actual particle, so it still hasn't been detected. And so what? God created everything. He spoke it into existence out of nothing, ex nihilo. So if it requires a neutralino, guess who created the neutralino? Dark matter is paired with another even stranger phenomenon known as dark energy. Dark energy is considered to be a weird repulsive force, sometimes called negative gravity. Between them, these two shadowy twins account, look at this, for 95% of the mass of the universe. In other words, 95% of the mass of the universe is invisible and undetectable. Now, you tell me that that doesn't take faith. And that's legitimate. No, I'm not. That's legitimate. I had faith. But don't call me as a Christian blind faith and ignorant, because I have faith in the God who created it. You see, they both require immense faith, but the math falls in favor of the special creation. 95% is missing. Look at this. So what that tells us, and here's how the scientists think, well, even though we can't detect it, we can't see it, it has to be there. Because if it isn't there, if it wasn't there, then we wouldn't be here. Because that is what's holding the entire universe together, folks. That's what's keeping everything right where it's supposed to be. So you can then, as I did, bow down before the temple of science and have great faith in this invisible particles, or you can go to the God who wrote in the only book I still have that is not obsolete. He tells me right here what's holding it together. Science is just guessing and making these speculations, but look at what God says. Colossians 1, 16 and 17. Christ is the one through whom God created everything in heaven and earth. He made things we can see and things we can't see. See, God already knew this. He knew about dark matter and dark energy. Everything has been created through him and for him. He existed before everything else began, and he, Jesus, holds all things together. It's pretty straightforward. So I choose to put my faith in this rather than in dark energy and dark matter. That is my choice. That's legitimate. You need to make choices. But, you know, before you can make a choice, you need to have all the information, don't you? I love this one. Look at the credentials on this guy. John A. Eddy, Astrogeophysics, High Altitude Observatory, Boulder, Colorado. This is out of the Geo Times, again, a non-Christian publication. He says, I suspect that the sun is 4.5 billion years old. Well, that's his speculation. That's his belief, which is legitimate. But, look at this. However, given some new and unexpected results to the contrary, and some time for frantic readjustment. Remember what I just told you about the scientific community. They are in a state of frantic readjustment, trying to adjust for this stuff. I suspect that we could live with Bishop Usher's figure for the age of the earth and sun, approximately 6,000 years. He says, I don't think we have much in the way of observational evidence in astronomy to conflict with it. So the empirical observational evidence does not support 4.5 billion years. It's just his belief. And you know what? That's legal. But let's just call it. Some scientists believe. No problem. But when the students are force-fed, scientists have proven that is wrong. That's not right. See, God tells us in Romans 1:20 that we are without excuse. So if we are without excuse, then obviously God created the information so that we wouldn't have an excuse, right? He says, for since the creation of the world, God's invisible qualities, his eternal power and divine nature have been clearly seen, being understood from what has been made, so that all men are without excuse. His very creation screams design. Every time I looked in a microscope as a biological scientist, I had to convince myself that what I was looking at wasn't designed because of the perfection. Now, I asked earlier, in fact, this morning, I said, how many people have heard of Dr. Werner Gett? Anybody in here heard of Werner Gett? Yeah, a couple. Sweet. Dr. Werner Gett is a physicist from the German Federal Institute of Physics. He's written numerous books, but the book that finally really impacted me was the book called In the Beginning Was Information. I do have a few of those on my table left. I don't know very many, but a couple. Dr. Gett is an information physicist, scientist. And this quote from his book, no scientist in the world will contradict. That's why they won't review his book. Because they don't want to say it's terrible or it's garbage or it's wrong. Because they don't even want you to know his name. Because if you go read it, then you'll find out for yourself that it is right on. Empirical. In many areas. But not everywhere. But see, he says right here, there is no known law of nature, no known process, and no known sequence of events which can cause information to originate by itself in matter. Does everybody follow that? That's pretty clear. So in other words, information does not originate by itself in matter. Well, then in the book, he explains what is information. The DNA is information. Every cell in your body, every single cell contains more information than the entire Library of Congress. Mathematics, math is information. The DNA is information. Words are information. It's a code. And what does a code require? Intelligence. So if you can't argue with this, what do you do about it? You ignore it. You just hope nobody reads it or hears about it. So we're going to look at information. What is information? Because if it doesn't originate by itself in matter, which no scientist says it does, then there's a simple question that needs to be asked. Where did it come from? Here it says, reality can be understood not only in terms of the flow of energy, but also in the terms of what? The flow of information. So says a team of physicists with a new take on quantum theory. This theory, which explains how matter behaves at the atomic scale, is built on an abstract mathematical formulation that seems to defy common sense. At the idea's core is a postulate called purification. Using this postulate and five axioms, and we're going to talk about axioms in just a minute, axioms drawn from what? Information theory. The researchers have derived the basic mathematical framework of quantum mechanics. The framework also predicts the phenomenon routinely observed in the lab, including entanglements. That's Einstein's spooky action at a distance. Now, that's this good science. But what are they attributing this to? Information. But yet we know information doesn't originate by itself in matter. So common sense would tell you that when I bought this computer, I didn't buy a little plastic box and all of a sudden it was full of information, did I? Who put the information in there? The creator of the computer. Where did the information in this lecture come from? The creator of the lecture. So where did the information in the universe come from? The creator of the universe. You see how just using common sense and logic? But we'll keep going. How many of you have heard of Stephen Hawking? He's the physicist, the on the wheelchair. He has reversed his opinion after 30 years about information. Wait till you see what that is. But look at this. We mentioned axiom. The primary axiom, by the way, is that's what the scientists call evolution, Darwinian. The primary axiom is mutation plus natural selection plus time. That is the primary axiom. That is Darwinian evolution. The problem is it's in direct conflict with the second law of thermodynamics. And we know that mutations do not add information. 100% of the time, which is empirically proven, mutations result in a loss of information. 100%. Never is there new information. And 99%, it's fatal. So 1% is benign. But that's the primary axiom. So Darwinian evolution depends and requires mutation to give new information to create new species. Common sense, again, tells us that that's not possible. An experiment by Reg Hogan, a physicist at the University of Chicago and director of the Fermilab Particle Astrophysics Center near Batavia, Illinois, will attempt, look at this, to measure the intimate connections among information, matter, and space-time. You see how important information is? But see here, information does not originate by itself in matter. So they're trying to figure out, well, where does it come from? As we recognize the higher order dimensions of the genome, this is from Dr. John Sanford, who wrote the book Genetic Entropy and the Mystery of the Genome. He's a geneticist at Cornell University. He says, as we recognize the higher order dimensions of the genome, I believe we can readily agree with Carl Sagan's oft-repeated statement that each cell contains more information than the Library of Congress. You see, I didn't just make that up either. So, indeed, human life is more complex than all human technologies combined. So, where did all this information come from? How can it possibly be maintained? This is the mystery of the genome that is creating an absolute panic within the scientific community. But again, information does not originate by itself in matter, and out of Discover magazine, look what it says. The cosmos contains roughly 10 to the 90th bits of what? Information. So if information doesn't originate by itself in matter, where did this monstrous number of bits of information come from? See, we don't want to tackle that. Science doesn't want to touch that. They don't want the kids to ask the questions. So that's why we're out here, just to let you know that those are some questions that need to be asked. But here's the other thing. It says by factoring in the available energy and the speed of light, what do you think they're doing that? Any of you computer literate know if you build a computer model, what's required? A constant. See, if you put bogus information in one side and you model it to infinity, you get what on the other side? Bogus information. So you need a constant. So they use the speed of light as a constant to build these models. But what if the speed of light isn't constant? What would that do to your model? So Lloyd, a scientist, Lloyd estimates that the universe could have performed at most 10 to the 120th logical operations since the Big Bang. If we wanted, look at this, if we wanted to simulate the universe on a computer, such a computer would have to be as powerful as the universe itself. Wow. In reality, though, look at this, we can only make crude approximations because all of the computers that have ever existed on this planet have just carried out just 10 to the 31st operations. Crude approximations falls within that definition from the National Academy of Science on empirical how. But see, there's nothing wrong with that. That's good science. But you can't use it to block teaching creation and then teach this. Let's just teach it all and stop this nonsense. But constants are required. How many have heard of the Hubble constant? That's one that's used. We're going to talk about that in a minute too. But let's continue with information. After nearly 30 years, the celebrated University of Cambridge, this is out of Science News. This magazine comes out weekly. It's a great journal if you're a scientist. After nearly 30 years, the celebrated University of Cambridge cosmologist Stephen Jay Hawking has reversed his opinion. Even black holes can't destroy what? Information. He announced in July at the International Conference of General Relativity and Gravitation in Dublin. He goes on down and he says, Hawking is aligned now with most physicists who long ago adopted as a sacred immutable law the concept that information, like energy, is never destroyed. But mind-bending paradoxes emerge when scientists try to figure out what happens when information falls into a black hole. According to one perspective, information seems to be in two places at once. Now let's go back and review. Information does not originate by itself in matter. That's accepted. Every physical event in cosmic history represents a piece of information. The universe contains 10 to the 90th bits of information. The DNA is information. Every cell in your body has more information than the Library of Congress. Information cannot be destroyed. Information seems to be in two places at once. Do you know anybody that can be in two places at once and can't be destroyed? I do. But where does information come from? Words are information. Information is a code. Information requires intelligence. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. The same was in the beginning with God. All things were made by Him, and without Him was not anything made that was made. Where do you suppose information came from in the universe? The Creator of the universe. That's the only logical explanation. But let's go back to that computer model using the speed of light. A team of scientists, this is out of the Science Journal, a team of Australian scientists led by theoretical physicist Paul Davies has proposed that the speed of light may not be a constant. A revolutionary idea that can unseat one of the most cherished laws of modern physics, Einstein's theory of relativity. If so, physicists will have to rethink many of their basic ideas about the laws of the universe. When one of the cornerstones of physics collapses, it's not obvious what you hang on to and what you discard, Davies says. But see, it's not just the speed of light that's not a constant. This is out of USA Today. Look what it says. Public confidence in the constants of nature may be at an all-time low. Recent research has found evidence that the value of certain fundamental parameters, such as the speed of light, the invisible glue that holds nuclei together, that's your dark matter, dark energy, together may have been different in the past. There is absolutely no reason these constants should be constant, says astronomer Michael Murphy of the University of Cambridge. These are famous numbers, but we have no real reason for why they are what they are. You would expect variation in all the fundamental constants, Murphy says. You see, that's good science. That's legitimate. But then let's look at where it legitimately leads us. So you can't eliminate one half and make it fit in the box you want it to fit. You need to let it take you where it leads, where the evidence leads. But as I said, I had absolute great faith in man's word. My prayer again this morning, God, give me as much faith in your word as I had in man's word. Because I want to show you, and this is out of Astronomy Magazine, but this is what I believed. And what a lot of my colleagues believed. Now tell me which takes more faith. Let's just go down here to the bottom here. It's talking about matter and antimatter and how one survived annihilation, you know, from the Big Bang and that sort of thing. It says, so how did matter survive annihilation? It is possible that antimatter did survive, but it somehow resides in a distant part of the universe that is too far away to see. It could be that there are what? Anti-people and anti-galaxies somewhere else, notes MIT physicist Jonathan Fang. But that would have some strange consequences which have not been seen. Now, see, I accuse the Christians of having blind faith and believing in a book that is so well documented archaeologically, historically, and yet I believed in that. Do you think I had a little more faith than most Christians? Yes. See, because I believed in anti-people and anti-galaxies. Now all I have to believe in is the God of the universe who tells me everything that my science didn't. But see, and I wasn't the only one, folks. There's still a lot of my friends who still believe this. And as I said earlier, what's happening in the science journals is we're turning to transpermia and panspermia as an explanation to the origin of life because Darwinian evolution is bankrupt. So we turn to those things, which is that aliens started life here. One theory is that an asteroid slammed into a planet far, far away that had life on it, and bits of it flew out into space, and part of it got tagged onto a comet tail, traveled around the universe for billions of years, and then a piece of it fell as a meteorite onto Earth where the life sprang into existence. Now, is that a pretty good empirical? It's a good theory. It's a scientific theory, but what kind of faith does that take? The other theory is that aliens, actual intelligent life somewhere else, flew here and planted that first cell. Anything but God, you see? Because there's only two choices, and I did not want to believe in God. Now, here is the guy I was telling you about. A brilliant man. I was on the board of directors at UC Santa Cruz for a while. One term. Once they found out I was a Christian, that didn't get elected the second term. But Dr. David Deamer, a brilliant man. And one of the things, once you obtain your PhD, you become a grant writer. The TAs do all the teaching. It's almost disheartening. So I was so busy trying to get grant money to do research and to pay for my fine home at the beach and my BMW. But Deamer was pretty wise. Look at this. This man obtained 20 years of continuous funding from NASA's exobiology and astrobiology. I mean, that's brilliant. But Dr. David Deamer, what he was trying to do as a chemistry and biochemistry acting chair at UCSC, he says, the formation of soap bubbles is no mere curiosity. It illustrates the essential property of the kind of molecules that compose the membranes of living cells. So what he wanted to do is see if spontaneous generation could actually happen. So Deamer has been investigating the origins of life, look at this, for more than 20 years with continuous funding from NASA's exobiology and astrobiology. Of course, it took me a while to figure out what an exobiologist or an astrobiologist is. I'd never met one until recently. I did. An astrobiologist or an exobiologist, those are the people that study life in outer space. There's your tax dollars at work, folks. They've been real successful. But so how successful was David Deamer? 20 years of research with your money. Says Charles Darwin, in a letter to his friend J.D. Hooker in 1871, speculated about life beginning in a warm little pond. Many scientists, however, now believe that life may have begun in extreme environments such as undersea hydrothermal vents and volcanoes with their abundance of chemicals and energy. While many scientists have attempted to test this hypothesis in the lab, do you catch what he said, attempted? The Miller-Urey and all of those experiments that were total failures? Deamer was the first to do so in the field. Well, why not? With 20 years of funding, I would be out there myself. But here's the results of that. The results were strikingly negative. Well, I could have told him that for half the money. It says, life did not emerge. No membranes assembled themselves. No amino acids combined into proteins. Instead, the added chemicals quickly vanished, mostly absorbed by the clay particles in the pool. Instead of supporting life, the bubbling pool snuffed it out before it even began. But when you have 20 years of funding, Deamer repeated the same experiment at Lassen Volcanic National Park in Northern California with the same negative results. So again, let's just take common sense and the math and realize that in the lab, scientists have tried since 1950s to create life in a test tube. They tried, they thought they created some amino acids, but that was even a failure because they didn't even create a real amino acid. And the ones that they supposedly created were single-handed and they dissolved into a red goo. And an amino acid is not life. It is merely a building block for a protein. So I asked the experimenter, by the way, the guy who built that apparatus, the Miller-Urey experiment, his name is Dr. Ed Peltzer. At the time, he was a grad student for Stan Miller. My wife and I have spoken on the same conference with Dr. Ed Peltzer. And he was telling me about the experiment. Great science, exciting stuff. But when it doesn't work, we need to admit it and move on. I even asked Dr. Miller, I said, you're trying to create an amino acid that you have to know which order and how many of them to make to put them just to make a single protein. And then you have to put the proteins in the right order to make a cell. I said, how about if I give you all of the amino acids in the correct order and all of the proteins in the correct order? He said, what do you mean? I said, I'm going to give you a living cell. And we're going to put it in a vacuum. And we'll snuff it out. All I want you to do is bring it back to life. He turned bright red and left the room. Why? Well, if you can't build it, if you can't start it when you have all the pieces, how are you going to build it from scratch and start it? You see, only the Creator, only God can create life. So in the lab, it didn't work. In the field, it didn't work. And by the way, Deamer wasn't the only one to try this. Other people thought, well, since he got all that funding, maybe he just didn't do it right. So there's been much research done. So what went wrong? The explanation is simple, so you should all know it. Said Deamer, the explanation is simple, who presented his findings in February at a meeting of the Royal Society of London. He said, conditions in geothermal springs and similar extreme environments just do not favor membrane formation. And here he is honest. He sums it up honestly. He says, well, we have to face up to the biophysical facts of life. Hot acidic hydrothermal systems are not conducive to self-assembly processes. So what does that do to Darwin's warm little pond? You see why Darwinian evolution is bankrupt? It's good science, good experiments, but let's move on. Let's give other explanations, ones that make more sense. Well, we're going to finish here. I'm going to get into the gene pool, the human genome. Dr. John Sanford did some absolutely phenomenal work. He and a team of scientists. Will you see the credentials of this team of scientists that went over the Human Genome Project, page by page, verse by verse, and the things they found were amazing. The number one thing is how absolutely spectacularly complex it was, but the entropy of the genome, that means it's subject to what? Remember what I started with? The second law of thermodynamics? Everything is decaying, including your genome. They have speculated that that may be the reason we're finding so much more autism, diabetes, all of these things that are coming out. But nature has a way of thinning out the gene pool as well, doesn't it? I thought this was, a friend of mine sent me this, says, sometimes Mother Nature has her way of thinning out the genes. Yeah? Well, here we go. Modern Darwinism, here it is, John Sanford, Cornell University, Genetic Entropy and the Mystery of the Genome. Modern Darwinism is fundamentally built upon what I will call the primary axiom. That's what I told you. The primary axiom is that man is merely the product of random mutations plus natural selection within our society's academia. The primary axiom is universally taught and almost universally accepted. It is repeated endlessly on every college campus. It is very difficult to find any professor on any college campus who would dare to question the primary axiom. It is for this reason that the overwhelming majority of youth will lose their faith while at college. I believe this is also the cause of the widespread self-destructive, self-denigrating behaviors we see throughout our culture. So what is a primary axiom? It's a concept that is not testable. Catch this. The primary axiom. An axiom is a concept that is not testable and is accepted by what? Faith, because it seems obviously true to all reasonable parties. On this basis, it is accepted as absolute truth. Remember that article I showed you out of the Science Journal yesterday, where it says that they routinely present this to students, the public, and the press as fact. Even though they know it isn't, they present it as if it is. That is wrong. But it's taken by what? Faith. But yet we as Christians can't have faith. That's not scientific. No, we need to have faith on both sides. Modern Darwinism is fundamentally built upon what I will call the primary axiom, which is that mutation plus time plus natural selection. That's what it's taught. It has become my conviction that the primary axiom is insidious on the highest level, having a catastrophic impact on countless human lives. Furthermore, every form of objective analysis, look at this, objective analysis I have performed has convinced me that the axiom is clearly false. So when you do the analysis, you do the research, and you look at it openly, it's not obviously true, it's obviously false. So common sense tells you. An organism genome is the sum total of all of the genetic parts, including the chromosomes, genes, and nucleotides. A genome is an instruction manual that instructs human cells to be human cells and the human body to be the human body. There is no, look at this, no information system designed by man that can even begin to compare to the simplest genome in complexity. Do you see that? You see how that requires the immensity of our God? We can't even come close to it. This double helix is the most sophisticated information system ever seen. And that's pretty empirical because that comes from the scientific community itself. But genetic entropy is the main cause, look at this, of extinctions and demonstrates why human DNA is inexorably deteriorating at an alarming rate and therefore cannot be millions of years old. A new computer program, look at this, called Mendel's Accountant, that you can all get on, they made it free. So teachers, Christians, high school teachers, public teachers, anyone can access this computer program. It's Mendel's Accountant. You go, I think it's mendelsaccountant.info. And then you can use the computer model to do any type of manipulating of the numbers you want and see what you come up with. So this model can now model population from beginning to present. What they did is they went back taking the Bible and looking at Adam and Eve as the first with no genetic entropy at all. No, they were created perfectly. So until the fall, till Adam's original sin, there was no genetic entropy. So then after the fall, then the entropy entered in. So that again helps explain the huge age is for the people prior to the flood. It has been used to empirically, you catch that word, remember if it's not empirical, it has been used to empirically falsify Darwin's theory of evolution. This program is the result of 4 years of research by a team of top scientists. More information can be obtained by going to mendelsaccountant.info. The team of scientists headed by Dr. John Sanford, a professor of genetics at Cornell University. Now look at these guys. Dr. John Baumgartner and Dr. Wes Brewer, both numerical scientists, and Dr. Paul Nelson and Walter D. Remine, both population geneticists. And by the way, Paul Wilson has two PhDs. For more detailed explanation, you can read the book Genetic Entropy and the Mystery of the Genome, which I have out there. But they went back, modeled entropy, starting with Adam and Eve. And they based it on the genealogy of the Bible, where people lived hundreds of years. Well, as the genome kept going out and the genealogy came down, it bottlenecked at 8, which you would expect because there was only 8 people on the ark. So the numbers fit perfectly. Then from there out to now. After modeling this, they found that you cannot go back more than 8,000 years or the human population would have been extinct. So without God's quality control system, which is called natural selection, we would not be sitting here tonight. Natural selection can only keep up with a certain amount. So by now we should clearly see that the primary axiom is not inherently true. Nor is it obvious to all reasonable parties. And so it is very clear that it should be rejected as an axiom. Moreover, what is left, the primary hypothesis, mutation, selection, can create and maintain genomes, is actually found to be without any support. In fact, multiple lines of evidence indicate that the primary axiom or primary hypothesis is clearly false and must be rejected. In June, a large consortium of genome scientists under the name of ENCODE presented, look at this, a set of 29 scientific papers. The findings have stunned the genetic community. They show that the human genome is vastly more complex than they had expected. They conclude that the most nucleotides are not only functional, but this is the part that blew my mind. They are polyfunctional, meaning multiple facets. They code for more than one thing. Mathematically, that is absolutely mind-boggling. This means that the genome's functionality actually exceeds 100%. Essentially, all mutations, look at this, all mutations must be considered deleterious. This means that the real deleterious mutation rate in man is nothing less than a staggering well over 100 mutations per generation. And by now, by the way, that number has jumped, they're up as high as maybe 300. But at this point, it was 100. And by the way, they only used 10 as a quality control. Says this is more than an order of magnitude greater than was considered possible just 5 years ago. But this is empirical. This is stuff you can go check yourself. So here it is. We have reviewed compelling evidence that even when ignoring deleterious mutations, mutation and selection cannot create a single gene within the human evolutionary timescale. So when deleterious mutations are factored back in, we see that mutation selection cannot create a single gene ever. This is the overwhelming evidence against the primary axiom. In my opinion, this constitutes what is essentially a formal proof that the primary axiom is false. So I want to sum it up right here. This last slide, and then Russ is going to come up. We're going to take a little potty break. Russ will come up and wait till you see what he finishes with. But here it is. This sums it up. Let God be true and every man a liar. Romans 3:4. Thank you, folks.